Hello and welcome to the Stushy, the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media. As you can tell by the jingle bells, we are doing a slight Christmas special in that we are recording a podcast the week before Christmas. My name is Paul Malik. I am the Courier's political editor. I'm joined across the DC Thompson portfolio from reporters across the country once again. From Edinburgh, we have the Press and Journal's political editor, Tom Peterkin. Also joining us from Edinburgh, we have the Press and Journal's investigations editor, Callum Ross. And joining us all the way from down south in sunny London is Mr. Dan O'Donoghue, the Westminster correspondent for the Press and Journal. Good morning, all three of you.
Morning.
Hello.
Good morning.
How are we all this fine festive December morning? Are we pumped and ready to go for politics news? I know I am. Let's get straight to it. Now, we are recording this on the Friday before Christmas. Of course, Christmas is on a Friday this year, so this is a full week in advance, and we are all getting ready to put our stockings up and spend a bit of time with our loved ones. Now, of course, as is their wont, the Scottish, UK, Welsh and Northern Irish governments have made the Christmas lockdown rules very, very easy to understand, and to show us how easy the rules are, we're all going to discuss them for the next 5 minutes to see who will be breaking the rules and where they will be breaking them this Christmas. Dan, you've been following, of course, the Westminster announcements and the sort of differences that they have with the Welsh Assembly and the Northern Ireland local government as well. I think it's fair to say that the messaging is a bit mixed and there are rules that differ between the four nations, aren't there? Can you talk us through them a little bit?
Yeah, well I'll try. I mean, it feels like this was always going to happen, really. I mean, we had this announcement a couple of weeks ago, of course, about, you know, having Christmas bubbles and, you know, there'd be a couple of days relaxation where people could travel around the UK, you know, whether it's England, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland, and stay over with family for a few days. You know, and everybody, of course, wants to celebrate Christmas and, you know, it gave us a little bit of a boost. But, you know, really looking down the track, given the infection numbers, it was always going to happen where we get to a point where we are now where, you know, everyone's saying, is it really a good idea to kind of say to people, yeah, you can get out of kind of tier three areas, potentially go to tier two areas and, you know, spread this infection around the country. So there's been this debate this week around, you know, should we stick to this Christmas bubble plan that was announced? And so broadly, yes, we are sticking to the plan, but basically they've kind of tweaked it a little bit depending on what nation you're in. So in England and Northern Ireland, up to three households can still form a bubble for 5 days. In Scotland, it's three households, but they're being asked just for 1 day, not the 5 day original period. And in Wales, it's just two households to mix. But of course, each leader, you know, Boris, Nicola Sturgeon, Mark Drakeford in Wales, everybody is kind of really tough on the language around this now and said, you know, really think about, do you actually want to go home for Christmas? You know, can you just put it off? Maybe have a Zoom chat or, you know, just maybe meet in the garden and have Christmas dinner outside or something. It's just bonkers. I mean, I don't know if anyone saw that ridiculous, any of our listeners saw that ridiculous Matt Lucas sketch at the beginning of lockdown about the guidance where he was kind of saying, you know, go to work, don't go to work. It feels like that again. It's kind of, you know, go home for Christmas, don't go home for Christmas. It's, you know, really, really confusing to be honest. I don't know if anyone else has made much sense of it.
That's very well put, Dan, I think. For me, what I think sort of is potentially confusing for punters is that there was a lot of sort of talk ahead of last week that they were going to have to tighten the rules, and the joint governments came out and said, well, no, that the rules will stay the same, but we're going to tighten the guidance in slightly different ways across the four nations. So you have this sort of anomaly whereby you know, you may be, strictly speaking, technically obeying the rules, but you're disobeying the guidance if you spend, you know, a night in your relative's house or something like that. So it's, And I think it's been tricky for people. I mean, of course, everyone acknowledges that, you know, you really can take no chances with this virus. But it is tricky for people who've made plans based on the rules, but are now being told, well, the guidance is that your plans can't go ahead. So it's not very festive. And when we have Nicola Sturgeon at one of the briefings saying, you know, well, perhaps you could go and meet your nearest and dearest who you haven't seen for months. You know, one thing you could do is meet up in the garden, and when you could do that for half an hour, because that's probably the only amount of time you'll be able to bear before it gets too chilly at Christmas. So Merry Christmas, everyone.
And I suppose even with that, if they did make it legal, could you imagine the field day we'd have with the front pages as well if people got arrested for visiting granny on Christmas Day? It'd be really something, wouldn't it?
Oh yeah.
I mean, it is wild. It is one of those ones as well where we realize the sort of size and impact of Christmas. People talk about the UK not really being a religious country anymore, but of course, Christmas seems to be getting almost a special dispensation, whereas opposed to the Jewish holiday of Hanukkah, we've just sort of passed Eid in the last couple of months. Which is the Muslim holiday, and these religions and the followers of that have just had to sort of accept that the guidance is applying during these festivals and during these holidays, and that they can't meet up, or that they're going to have to meet up under the strictest of lockdowns. But there seems to still be a special dispensation across the UK, almost acknowledging that people are just going to break the rules anyway. That was one of the original thoughts, wasn't it, Dan?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting you raised that there. And I mean, I was debating this session with one of my friends the other day. I think it's just British exceptionalism, I think. You know, it's so often the case, you know, as we've seen throughout the Brexit process, you know, that we can kind of, you know, maybe do things better, or, you know, we're going to be first with the vaccine, we're going to have a world-beating system. You know, it always seems the case that us Brits can do it differently, and it'll be a different outcome. And it feels the same with Christmas, really. It's kind of, you know, while of course the guidance has been, you know, for, you know, the millions of people who, you know, follow other religions in this country, oh no, you must follow the guidance, you know, it's hard, we know, but, you know, you have to stick to it. But, you know, as soon as it comes to Christmas, it's, you know, 5-day break, you know, yeah, go and see granny and all the rest of it. And it's kind of, you know, as I say, it's just, you know, every other time we've been promised something where, you know, us Brits will do it differently or better, it's not really worked out that way. So everyone's a bit fearful now, really, about how this is going to turn out in the new year, you know, whether we're going to kind of see, you know, these infection rates explode, or, you know, another lockdown, or God knows what. It's just quite worrying, really.
And Callum, how do you feel about the whole thing? Do you feel safe in the knowledge that you'll be doing the right thing by the guidance or the law, or are you as confused as the rest of us?
Well, I kind of feel in two minds about the whole thing. Luckily, my wife and I had already decided to stay at home for Christmas and not travel. So we've just got a decision to make about whether, you know, visitors are going to come around or not. I mean, obviously, it feels like the governments have not handled this well so far, and the consequences could be, you know, quite serious. But I do have some sympathy with how they got into this position. You know, it's a difficult call to make. On the one hand, you know, it's been a tough year for almost everyone in the country, and, you know, they want a little bit of respite. Over the holidays, I know, you know, I used to do Dan's job, and I lived in London in a bedsit by myself, no family, in England at all. The thought of you being stuck there for Christmas Day is pretty grim, to be honest. But at the same time, you know, if the consequences are as severe as they might be, then this is going to be another pretty grave mistake by our decision makers, and one, you know, an avoidable one. So yeah, it's it's difficult, and I'm glad I'm not the one that's having to make those decisions.
Now, Callum touched upon a very important point there. We should point out that DC Thompson's newspapers, the Preston Journal and the Courier, are running a loneliness campaign along with BT, where you can find out more information about how to get through this Christmas, which might be a little bit different for you, and you know, give you the advice that you might need should you be feeling, or should you notice someone who might be lonely this Christmas. If you pick up one of our papers, there's plenty of information on there, or of course visit one of our very forward-thinking websites. Now, 32 years ago this week, Scotland was subject, completely against its will, to one of the worst terrorist atrocities, really in living memory, after the Pan Am flight blew up over Lockerbie, killing everyone on board and people on the ground. Subsequently, a Libyan operative called Abdul Basit Al-Megrahi was convicted of the crime. He was then released on compassionate grounds by former Justice Secretary Kenny McCaskill, who's now an MP. Now, it turns out that there might be some new information regarding the Lockerbie bombing and how the case has been handled. Now, Tom, you've been speaking with former FBI agents and Mr. McCaskill this week regarding this this subject. And can you talk us through a little bit about what you've been finding out?
Yes, Paul. So this the big news was that reports from the USA were that the American prosecutors are pursuing a Libyan called Abu Aguila Massoud. In connection with the Lockerbie bombing, they're seeking extradition from him from Libya. There is talk that he is, you know, they're seeking to charge him within a reasonably short period of time. So, of course, this is a very big development in what has been, a huge, huge and tragic story: the deaths of 270 people, the biggest terrorist outrage on UK territory, and it's been something that's been with us, as you say, for 32 years. So this is obviously a very significant development, which could lead to, one assumes, a criminal trial. So I was, as someone who sort of dipped in and out of this story over the last few years, I managed to speak to a chap, Richard Marquis, who's the FBI agent who led the original investigation in the early 90s, who had some interesting things to say about this character, Massoud. He said that basically this guy had been on their radar way back then, that they regarded him as someone who was crucial to the investigation. Their intelligence suggested that he was the technician who may have manufactured the bomb, which led to the outrage, and that, you know, frustratingly from his point of view, they were unable to get the enough evidence to deal with him back then. But obviously since then there have been some developments. And in fact, that was sort of Kenny McCaskill, who, as you say, was Justice Secretary, who released the only man ever convicted of the atrocity, Abdul Basit Al-Megrahi. He released him on compassionate grounds because he had prostate cancer back in 2009, I think. Kenny McCaskill was also of the view that Massoud, you know, had been sort of under strong suspicion right from the very beginning of when the investigation started. But what seems to have happened is that, or at least in the meantime, since the early 1990s, a journalist called Ken Dornstein, who lost his brother David in the atrocity, has done quite a lot of work on this, including an investigative documentary called Lockerbie, My Brother's Bomber. And he's found out some very interesting information, in particular linking Massoud to a 1986 bombing at a Berlin discotheque, plus has spoken to various contacts of his who have linked him to the 1988 Lockerbie bombing. Meanwhile, Massoud is in a Libyan jail, some reports suggest, and is coming to the end of his sentence, and now attention is turning onto him. And so it's a very interesting development. Robert Black, Professor Robert Black, who was one of the, he's often described as the architect of the Camp Zeist court, which tried Mr. Megrahi all those years ago originally, which was set up in Holland and run under a panel of judges under Scots law. He was interesting about that. He was very, he said one of the key questions is, why has this happened now? And he advanced a couple of theories, one being that this was something that Bill Barr, the U.S. Attorney General, is about to quit. It was revealed this week. And he is someone who, he in fact was acting Attorney General back in 1991 when Megrahi was charged. And so he has, you know, been very hot on Lockerbie as a subject. So there's sort of speculation saying, is this linked to his departure? There's also other piece of speculation that Professor Black was mentioned was that this could be linked. Now this was heavily caveated that this is a very, very cynical view to take, but this could be linked to Megrahi's family. Abdul Basit al-Megrahi has passed away. Megrahi's family are currently appealing his conviction, and it's in front of a panel of Scottish judges. And the theory being that this release could be an effort by the Americans to try and sort of influence that process, although I don't think Scottish judges would ever be influenced by that sort of thing, but to try and underline Libyan involvement in the bombing. So it's a sort of many-stranded sort of, it's a story which leads to many strands. And another interesting thing, talking to Kenny McCaskill, the former Justice Secretary, was that he was suggesting, you know, he was asking why, if they're pursuing Massoud, they, you know, why aren't they pursuing Abdullah al-Zanusi, who's another character who's been linked with this atrocity for, you know, decades now. And it's the late dictator Colonel Gaddafi's sort of brother-in-law, who was sort of regarded as his henchman and has long been associated with the atrocity. So it's one of these stories that these developments that have sort of led to a whole strand of speculation and interesting angles.
I mean, that is one of the interesting things. Is there any suggestion that Massoud was working on behalf of Gaddafi's state at the time? Or do we not know? Is he considered a rogue agent or anything of that sort?
I don't know for sure, Paul, but I think the suggestion is that he was part of a Libyan, you know, that Kenny McCaskill would say, you know, it's absurd to think that Megrahi was acting on his own, and that there was a whole cast of characters involved in perpetrating, this, you know, terrorist operation. The other thing I should just say is that's of interest. You know, last time Megrahi was tried under Scots law by Scottish judges. So a question that people be interested in now is, you know, should he be tried in Scotland? Should the Massoud be tried in Scotland again, or is this something that the Americans are going to handle, take charge of? And you can expect a great deal more on this story in the weeks ahead, I suspect.
Now, Callum, you've been following the latest on the investigation into harassment complaints against Alex Salmond at Holyrood, haven't you? What can you tell us that has been unearthed this week?
That's right, Paul. I mean, the committee itself didn't meet in public on Tuesday. There were some private discussions, but we haven't been told what they were discussing, but there's still a focus on the previous week's evidence and the testimony from Peter Murrell. It's 10 days on, but we're still talking about it and the apparent contradictions it has raised. Mr. Murrell, who is, of course, the SNP's long-serving chief executive and the husband to Miss Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister, he didn't mention Mark MacDonald by name, the former early years minister, when he gave his evidence last week. But Mr. McDonald's case has kind of re-emerged as a result of it because Mr. Murrell described a process by which the SNP deals with harassment-type complaints, and the process he described under oath to the committee didn't seem to match up at all with the way complaints were handled when it came to Mr. McDonald after they first emerged in November 2017, leading to Mr. McDonald's resignation from government in a bit of a storm of controversy. Mr. Murrell suggested to the committee that the party's national secretary, the SNP national secretary, would normally deal with complaints to the party confidentially, that complaints would not be shared with anyone from another organisation, including, and he specifically said, including government civil servants. But we know from what Mr. McDonald has said in the past about his case is that he was first made aware of the complaint against him by Liz Lloyd, who is a civil servant and the First Minister's Chief of Staff. Now, that fact seems to raise only two possibilities, certainly in my mind. Either the SNP shared details of the complaint we know it received about Mr. McDonald with Miss Lloyd, who is a government official rather than a party staff member, and in that case that would seem to conflict with what Mr. Murrell told the committee if that was the case. Or alternatively, as was suggested to me by some SNP sources, the complaint Miss Lloyd discussed with Mr. McDonald the day before he resigned was not the one made to the SNP. It might have been a complaint to another organisation, but there's a problem with that explanation too, because if that was the complaint, if that was the case, you know, what was the complaint and where did it go to? If it was a complaint to the government, that's never been suggested before and it's never been mentioned to Mr. McDonald as I understand it. And that would, if it was a complaint to the government, then that would raise questions about how the government handled the process, and that would probably be part of the inquiry into the Alex Salmond handling of the Alex Salmond allegations. So it's a bit of a mystery, and the SNP seemed very reluctant to clarify the situation at all when I contacted them several times at the start of this week. And it does just seem to be another case of the lines between government and party becoming a bit blurred, which has been a theme of the inquiry to date, because you'll remember we discussed last week that there seemed to be a bit of a contradiction between Mr. Murrell's evidence and Miss Sturgeon's about whether she met Alex Salmond at the couple's home in her capacity as First Minister or as SNP leader. So I'm sure Mr. Murrell will be asked about all this again if he is recalled to the committee, as some MSPs have suggested they want to see happen, to kind of clarify some of these apparent contradictions.
It just seems to get murkier and murkier as it goes on. Speaking of murky, Dan, you've been following the latest developments with Brexit. Tell us, are we going to get a deal and is everything going to be fine on New Year's Day, or will all hell unleash on Dover, Stranraer, Rosyth and every other coast, port, airport, you name it. We've got it and it's going to be a disaster. What's going on, Dan?
Well, I mean, at this point, you're best off getting Mystic Meg on to tell you, to be honest, because I don't really think anyone knows what's going on. I mean, as we're recording this morning, the EU chief negotiator, Michel Barnier, has injected a bit of drama. Not that we need that at all into the saga. He said that there are only a few hours left for the UK and EU to agree a deal. His comment, of course, follows the decision of the European Parliament this week to say that they basically need to see the text of a deal by Sunday if MEPs are going to be able to ratify it in time for the December 31st deadline. But, you know, just looking at what's been said, you know, is there much new here? You know, we've been told for the last year there's no time and, you know, deadlines have come and gone. You know, kind of digging into the detail of what's been said. I mean, I thought it was interesting to note that there seems to be some movement on fisheries, which of course has been one of the most contentious issues. Michael Gove was before the Brexit Committee in the Commons yesterday, and he said that the UK was willing to have a staged approach to quotas. Basically, it's kind of, that's a bit of a step change from saying, you know, from day one, we're going to take back control of all our waters and all our fish. I mean, essentially what he's saying is that it's an acknowledgement, really, that, you know, when we become an independent coastal state, the UK fishing industry won't have the boats, the crews, the infrastructure to start catching all the new quota that comes in. So the idea is that over kind of the next couple of years, as we're building more kind of infrastructure, we'll take on more quota, and it will reduce for the EU. You know, Brussels seems to be on board with this, but at the moment they're kind of asking for that to be spread over kind of an 8 to 10 year period, something that still is not palatable to the UK side. I think we're looking for, you know, a lot less, given, you know, the referendum was in 2016, we're now in 2020, you know, another kind of 8 to 10 years, you know, I think you'd have a lot of angry fishing communities if that was the case. But, you know, if they do come to some sort of agreement today or over, because I mean, negotiators are still in Brussels, kind of, you know, locked in horrible rooms, talking about kind of trying to hammer out the details. So, you know, if they can come up with an agreement, you know, over the weekend, then it's likely that Parliament, which has kind of now broke up for Christmas, they'll be recalled, and MPs will head back down to London next week, and they basically will be tasked with kind of racing through a trade agreement in time for us to leave on the 31st. But I mean, as I've said before, you know, don't be surprised if we're still wondering what the hell is going on the 31st. So, you know, nothing is, as Theresa May said, you know, nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. So,
I mean, that's what you want ultimately, isn't it? You want both parliaments to be sitting there with a document 3 days before Christmas, making their way through it as fast as they can. That's yeah, definitely guaranteed not to catch any mistakes, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%.
I mean, the whole process has just been madness from the very beginning. It's just, you know, regardless of what side, you know, leave or remain, you know, you would hope that you know, once the decision had been made and everything had gone down, that, you know, that time, you know, it seems like both parliaments have the same attitude that I took in my undergraduate dissertation, which is like, oh, the deadline is just a construct of my mind, and actually I'm going to push it as far as I can.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the most deranged aspects of this is that, you know, we're seeing all these adverts, you know, stressing to businesses to get ready, but it's kind of, you know, get ready for what? It's just, it's crazy.
Get ready for Thunderdome. The, yeah, that's the thing that gets me as well, is, you know, they still, the last check, to use fishing as an example, we sat for a committee where the fishing body said they don't even know what stickers they're going to be putting on their exports that they send over to the EU. Is it going to say GB for Great Britain? Is it going to say UK for United Kingdom? I haven't even sorted that detail out. It's a beggar's belief that, you know, any of the five times the amount of paperwork and bureaucracy is going to be done on time, and it's only going to harm the smallest and the most susceptible businesses, which haven't exactly had the greatest year in the first place. Ahead of this, I don't know if you saw the footage from Sky News this morning of the lorries parked up beside the M20. Did anyone see that?
I've seen it many times before, kind of images.
Well, if you like lorries and you like queues and you're in for a treat, I would advise checking that out on Twitter. Now, I know. Last week I promised, because it was a Christmas special, that we would do a double dunter on Stitch of the Week. And I've looked through it, and the news has all been quite serious this week. Any of you guys think of anyone who deserves to be given the Stoosh treatment?
Well, we saw this week some very alarming drug death statistics, and we saw Joe Fitzpatrick, the public health minister, who has astonishingly enough been very quiet during the coronavirus. This is the ball is in his court on this one, and we saw him getting a less than ringing endorsement from Nicola Sturgeon at First Minister's Questions when she apologised for these appalling deaths and admitted that this really wasn't good enough.
Absolutely right. I would second that one. Almost the only thing I would say is that it's almost too serious to be joking about, but this isn't a joke. 72 people in Dundee, where the public health minister represents, died this year. It's an increase on 66 from last year. and it has increased every year for 6 years. So I think, Tom, you're absolutely right. But we'll actually forgo any of the music because it is actually incredibly serious. Dan, what about you?
Well, I kind of feel guilty nominating this person because I kind of find it quite funny. I don't know if any of our listeners or any of you guys saw the Inverness MP, Drew Hendry. He literally took matters into his own hands in the House of Commons chamber this week. He was kind of irate at the passage of the Internal Market Bill, which kind of course, gives a lot of powers back to Westminster, basically to kind of spend in devolved areas. And he had a bit of an argy-bargy with the kind of government benches and the Speaker, who eventually took the ultimate action you can against an MP, which is to name them, which is to give their name, full name from the chair of the House of Commons, and that essentially bars you from the chamber for 24 hours. And in response to this, Drew Hendry marched to the dispatch box and picked up the royal ceremonial mace and attempted to leave the House of Commons chamber with it. He was quickly grabbed by the doorkeepers, but I mean, he joins an illustrious club with the likes of Michael Heseltine and John McDonnell and a couple of others who've tried to do the same. But as I say, I mean, I feel really guilty nominating Drew for that because I did actually find it quite funny, but I'll leave it to you guys as the jury of whether he deserves a Stoosh of the Week for that.
I think, I think that definitely suggests a Stoosh of the Week. That is almost the definition of a Stooshy, isn't it? It's a sort of argument out of nothing, out of nowhere.
Stoosh of the Week.
Well done, Drew Hendry. You get the Christmas Stoosh. On that note, I'd like to thank you all for tuning in or downloading or whatever it is you do to get your podcasts. I'd like to say thanks to Callum, Dan and Tom for joining us. I'd like to wish you all a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Happy Brexit Day when it comes. Join us in January for more Stooshy action on your podcast provider. I've been Paul Malik. Thank you very much and goodbye.
The Stooshy is the politics podcast from DC Thompson Media, bringing together political journalists and commentators from all over the country so that you are better briefed. Teams at The Courier, The Press and Journal, The Evening Telegraph and The Evening Express work hard every day, online and in print, to bring you careful reporting and analysis to help you understand the implications of what happens in Holyrood, Westminster and beyond. Subscribe to The Stooshy today, recommend us to friends and family, rate and review it if you have a moment, and let us know what you think of what we cover and how we cover it on Twitter and Facebook. We're Stooshy Scott on both. Be better briefed with The Stooshy from DC Thompson Media.